Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley and I'm super excited for this week's show because we are still under quarantine, but we are still podcasting and watching movies. This week we are discussing, at long last, at long listener request, The Mask of Zorro from 1998. And I am joined for this conversation by JB.
Did you miss me?
Always.
That's actually my new favorite line of dialogue from the movie.
Did you miss me?
It's one of Zorro's bon mots as he's fencing with Captain Love.
My favorite of his was, "Ya burnt."
He doesn't say that.
He says it so many times in this movie. So yes,
that's in the DIY version that you and Doug Schultz once filmed with a camcorder.
It was fun. I got to be Zorro. Our longtime listener and reader of the site, L. Gaith, has been asking us to podcast about The Mask of Zorro, his favorite film, for a long time.
Since 2017.
Okay. And so 3 years later, we are finally doing it. All you guys need is a national lockdown, and we will get around to your requests.
This is how we reward people who are loyal to us for almost half a decade.
That's right. So, J-Bones, how are you holding up?
Well, the joke I've been making is that I've been socially distancing myself since I retired 3 years ago. So I'm really good at it. Not much has changed.
All right. Well, that's good, I guess. It's a sad state of affairs. Have you seen anything good lately?
Well, I'll tell you, and I said this in a column a week or two ago, because who can keep track of the time anymore? It really warmed my black little heart that so many people I'm close to, and like so many people on the Twitter machine, the minute we have to stay in the house, we immediately self-medicate with movies. And so I guess I've always had an unlimited time to watch movies, but now I have even more unlimited time. So Frankenstein, the true story, which was something of a big event when I was a kid, when they first showed it on TV over two nights. Shout Factory finally put that out on the Blu-ray, and it called to mind the infamous Goonies derivation because I'm about halfway through it. It's endlessly long, and although there are good things in it, David McCullum plays Victor's friend Henry, and he's just amazing. And every time he's on screen, it's like, oh, well, this is very interesting. But it's endlessly long, and I'm not done with it. The transfer is beautiful, but it seems drawn out to be this impressive international piece of filmmaking.
Right.
Okay. Although James Mason hasn't shown up yet. I got the Star Wars 4K Blu-ray that came out last week.
Okay.
And I eagerly watched that, and I thought it looked astounding. Although, as I was watching it, my wife said something that I'm now going to use over and over and over again. Most of my little phrases are from her, that it bothers me so much that it's the special edition, because every time that stuff appears on the screen, she said it's like a thumb in your eye. And better minds than I have pointed out that once you get that ridiculous Jabba the Hutt segment, it makes no sense. Because Lucas, in reality, already knew that that wasn't going to work, and so rewrote the Greedo dialogue to contain all of that information.
Right.
So Han talks to Greedo. We find out what's going on. Han shoots Greedo. Don't get me started. And then he goes to the hangar and has the exact same conversation. I mean, almost the exact same conversation with puppet Jabba.
Have you bought Star Wars now as many times as you've bought the Universal Monsters?
I think the Universal Monsters wins. But here's my point. I'm watching the 4K Blu-ray, and it looks astonishing, except for when George Lucas is sticking his thumb in my eye. And then I began to think about those despecialized versions.
Yeah.
So I thought long and hard, who did I loan those to? Because I couldn't find them, and I actually remembered, and I texted this person, and this person very nicely returned them, observing social distancing standards and wiping things down with things. And so I watched the despecialized version on Blu-ray that a fan of the site had sent me maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And I got to tell you, the 4K Blu-ray and the despecialized version look essentially the same.
Oh, all right.
It's, I guess if you want to sit there and nitpick, you could. And they certainly don't look the same as each other. But the despecialized version looks amazing because that person spent some time on it. I finally got to see Godspell in a version that looks terrific.
Yeah, you wrote about it.
Right, because all the previous versions looked like a crappy VHS tape, and that was interesting. And I had pointed out that the commentary was very useful, and the guy who did the commentary found the column via Twitter, which was very what's the word? I really thought it was cool that he had read the column.
Definitely.
And that he liked it. The other night on TCM, they showed The Taking of Pelham 123.
Sure.
Could we argue that that's a perfect movie?
I would need to see it a couple more times, but it's pretty awesome.
Maybe it's because I'm starved for entertainment, but...
this is the remake you're talking about, right?
Oh, no. speaking of a thumb in your eye, every time I'm scrolling down that fucking cable guide, Taking a Pelham 123 is on a lot. And every time I fall for it and I click on it, and I love Denzel Washington, but God damn it. How about this? We strike an agreement. We strike a peace accord. Half the time you can show the new one.
Yeah.
But half the time, show the old one. I saw the old one on TCM, and it's so great. And to prove to you that everything is connected, one of the bad guys in Pelham 123 is Hector Elizondo. He's the psycho. Do you remember him?
Yeah, of course.
He's the psycho. And Hector Elizondo was in a Broadway show that's close to my heart called Steam Bath. He was the original god in Steam Bath. In fact, I think he was nominated for an Obie Award. And this week, watching The Mask of Zorro, I was fixated on one of the very minor heavies. He's only in two scenes. He's a little tiny sort of Mexican colonel of some sort. He's the guy who gets stuck in the tree at the end of the chase.
Yeah.
And that is Jose Perez. And Jose Perez was God in the famous PBS version of Steam Bath, which was, of course, the first television show to ever feature full frontal nudity.
Oh.
And because I have nothing but time, because I certainly ain't sleeping, someone nice uploaded the entirety of the Bill Bixby, Valerie Perrine, Jose Perez steam bath to the YouTube machine. So you can watch it anytime that you want.
I like Valerie Perrine.
And then finally, Bill Bixby acquits himself nicely.
No, he's good. I just rewatched The Apple Dumpling Gang, and he's fun in that.
The Apple Dumpling Gang was one of those movies where I was then too old for those movies.
Right.
But my friend Don and I would go to the Arlington Theater and like sit in the back and be jackasses anyway. And I often wonder, I wrote a column about it like 8 years ago. Like, how many little kids did I annoy?
Right.
With my snot nosiness, and what a fucking idiot I was. So if you're listening to this and you remember some jackass high school student improbably sitting through the Apple Dumpling Gang and ruining it for you, Tandy, the part that Bill Bixby plays in Steam Bath, is a very difficult part. And I watched it the other night again. I said, I'm going to watch 10 minutes of this. And I watched the entire thing. Bill Bixby is really, really good. And then finally, friend of the site, William Lantham, turned me on to some movies on iTunes and such that are being released in 4K. That there's no physical media 4K release, but iTunes has them in 4K. And one of them is the original War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
And I watched it this afternoon, and holy God, I know Martin Scorsese often sings the praises of the proprietary color widescreen movie system that Paramount had. Mm-hmm. And in the past, muddy VHS transfers were not a friend to what War of the Worlds is supposed to look like in terms of its color palette, like in terms of what the people decided it should look like. But oh my God, for $14, you can download it. You can also rent it on iTunes, and it is just spectacular looking. And as I mentioned before we started recording, I believe some digital magic was applied to remove some of the wires on the alien warships. I don't know if that's good or bad, but oh my God, does War of the Worlds look great now?
Wouldn't you agree that the wires are part of the charm?
Yes, although, and this is an experiment we might try once the global pandemic is over.
Mm.
I would be very interested with someone, let's say your son.
All right.
Someone of his age. And I don't know how to pose the question so you're not biasing him in one direction or another, but if the presence of the wires, not that it would be a deal breaker to him, but basically what I'm saying is, if you could set up some sort of experiment with 11-year-olds, which one would they prefer?
I don't know if it's about prefer.
The wires do pull you out.
Yeah, maybe, but that's like saying stop motion pulls you out. Like, why not just say this is how they did it, so this is how, you know, otherwise we're just offering them candy for dinner every day.
True, but again, and I don't mean to be the quibbler, it seems to me there's a difference between the wires on the alien warships and, let's say, and here I'm choosing my example very specifically, the fighting skeletons. In
sure, Jason the Argonauts.
Right, and clearly, I'm old and I can't go back to a time when I didn't see it when I was 12. But the stop motion in that has never pulled me out.
No, it never pulls me out either. But that's because.
But if you were to show it to an 11-year-old who was used to CGI,
exactly,
they would think it looks weird.
Right, exactly, and so I just think.
Might he say, Dad, how did they do that?
Maybe. If we are only showing them the most recent technology or whatever, then they never learn about how it used to be done. And they never get to appreciate some of the, let's call them handmade special effects of older movies. And I just would like there to be room for all of it.
No, I think you're right. And here's why, now that I've thought about it for 1 minute. Jan is doing a series of columns this month for National Poetry Month, and the first one was posted yesterday, and it's about Howl. And part of Howl is about the obscenity trial over the publishing of the poem Howl. And at one point, John Hamm, who's defending the guy who published it, says, "Did you ever notice whenever something like this comes to trial, the prosecution takes pains to say, now, this didn't compromise my morals, but I'm imagining a person whose morals would be compromised." Mm-hmm. That they're looking out for this anonymous, hypothetical third party. So I wasn't distracted by the wires when I was a kid. I just thought it was the craziest, scariest thing I had ever seen. And so I should give kids of this generation the same benefit of the doubt that they're smart enough or like movies enough that wouldn't be a deal breaker for them.
I'm sure it would be a deal breaker for casual movie fans. I don't know how many casual movie fans are watching the original George Pal War of the Worlds, but I feel like it's not that different from Ted Turner colorizing stuff where we say, well, people can't handle this one thing, so let's give them something more palatable. And I recognize that, you know, erasing some wires is not the same as colorizing an entire black and white movie. I'm not trying to equivocate the two, but I think the rationale is kind of the same.
And you just threw me back to my misbegotten past when I would make the case to my film study class that colorizing was bad, by showing the opening scene in the colorized Night of the Living Dead,
yeah,
where some idiot had decided that the zombies should be green. So in the regular film, we're very surprised when that man attacks Johnny, because we just thought he was grieving a family member in the cemetery. But in the colorized version, they see him from a long way away, and we're sitting there in the theater going, he's green! Don't you, are you color? He's green! Get away! He's green! And so that sort of, they stepped on their own foot.
Yeah. I was able to check out the new Criterion Blu-ray of Leave Her to Heaven for the first time, which I had never seen.
And what'd you think?
I liked it a lot. I read a little bit about it, and I've seen it characterized as a film noir. Would you call it a film noir? I wouldn't. I thought it was more melodrama than film noir.
I would not. I've noticed something, because I was canoodling around on iTunes today to download War of the Worlds. The iTunes has a film noir category. Boy, their definition of film noir is broad.
Yeah.
You know, I guess, you know, it's marketing, but no, I wouldn't consider that film noir. How does it look?
It looks great, obviously. It's, you know, that early Technicolor, so it's not quite War of the Worlds Technicolor, but it looks beautiful, obviously, and the Criterion restoration is great. And I had just rewatched Laura maybe 2 weeks ago, so it was cool to see Gene Tierney in another movie. My guess is that's why they're calling it a film noir, because they're like, I don't know, Gene Tierney's in it. It's got to be film noir.
Yeah. And Laura is so great. Obviously, this goes without saying. Criterion has jumped their usual level of excellence. Lately, every month when they put out what's coming down the road, it's like, oh, my God.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous. This deal that they seem to have struck with both Netflix and Neon, though, they're jumping the gun a little bit on some of the current movies.
Yes, but I think that's them. I'm guessing that with things, there were things where Criterion, before the whole Netflix thing, there were cases where Criterion was the first physical release of certain things.
Yeah, Wes Anderson's movies were sometimes like that.
And obviously Wes Anderson is a very specific case, but I think those did really, really well. And I think they're trying to cover their bases.
Yeah, I don't fault them for putting commercial movies in the collection. People balked, I know, when they did The Breakfast Club. Or going back to DVD, people were incensed that The Rock and Armageddon are both in the Criterion collection. I don't blame them for doing that. I think it's actually pretty interesting.
And I was happy to have a copy of Roma on physical media.
Yeah, right. And, you know, it's honestly just personal preference, because I'm excited to have The Irishman on Blu-ray. But then I'm like, why does Marriage Story need to be in there? And somebody else is going to be super excited about Marriage Story. So it's all just personal taste.
I think everyone's excited about Parasite.
Yeah, of course.
I don't think you'd find a person who wasn't. I agree with you about Marriage Story, but that's personal taste. I will undoubtedly buy it the day it comes out. But when they announce Buster Keaton and the cameraman, that's lesser Keaton. That's the film that sort of marks the decline. And it just, that announcement made me sad that the rights to that stuff went from Kino Lorber to Cohen Media Group.
Right.
Because can you imagine what the Criterion Collection would do with Keaton?
Yeah.
Why don't we give Criterion a good Keaton?
Well, you know, they did all the Chaplin movies and a bunch of Harold Lloyd movies.
We gave them the good Chaplin.
Right.
Although, to be fair, and I think there's a column about this if you want to look it up, the Cohen Keaton stuff is amazing.
Yeah.
Because the Kino stuff looked great. Oh, that might be stuff I bought more than Universal Monsters.
Buster Keaton?
I had Buster Keaton on VHS,
okay.
On Laserdisc,
okay.
Again on Laserdisc. Yeah, that might rival Universal Monsters, which of course will lead to a Buster Keaton meets Frankenstein.
I'm into it.
And to show you that I have too much shit in my head, are you ready for this?
Always.
Buster Keaton has met Frankenstein, because back in the 40s, once a year, the Screen Actors Guild would do a charity baseball game. and all the stars would come out. And Buster Keaton, like, was in charge of, like, adding jokes.
Okay.
I'm not making this up.
I believe you.
I have a photograph. Glenn Strange showed up to play Frankenstein's monster, full makeup and costume, and he did a bit with Keaton at the plate where Keaton was the umpire and Keaton keeps fainting.
Wow.
So there.
I thought you were going to say, because I was trying to remember if Keaton and Karloff appeared in any of the AIP movies together in the 60s. I don't think they did. I can't think of one that they're both in, but that's not the same as actually meeting Frankenstein, which right. is what you just described.
And there's that rotating group of Karloff and Peter Lorre and Keaton, and which warms my heart, because to think that the audience for the Beach Party movies were sitting there at the drive-in and they were like, oh, there's Peter Lorre, there's Boris Karloff, there's Buster Keaton, and might actually know who they were,
right,
or were introduced to them via Beach Party. Way to go, AIP.
We also watched Downhill, which came out around Valentine's Day. It's Will Ferrell and Julia Louis-Dreyfus in the American remake of Force Majeure.
And Downhill is one of those movies that very quickly went to VOD because the theaters closed.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
You think of Downhill?
I thought it was okay. I honestly was expecting it to be worse. I liked Force Majeure a lot, and this movie removes, you know, in much the same way that a lot of American remakes do, removes a lot of the subtlety and nuance of Force Majeure. It's not as, like, silly and slapsticky as I was expecting it to be with Will Ferrell in the lead. And it's well made enough. Like, it's okay. I was expecting much worse. I thought it was okay.
The two of them did a lot of talk shows to publicize it. And I saw Will Ferrell and Julia Louis-Dreyfus on a whole bunch of talk shows. And to be fair, I haven't seen the movie, but I've seen a lot of scenes from the movie on these talk shows.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me as if Julia Louis-Dreyfus was the only one who wasn't phoning it in.
Yeah, Will Ferrell doesn't have much of a part to play, despite him being so pivotal to what that movie is about.
Yeah.
If you guys don't know, it's about a family that goes on a skiing vacation, and there is a controlled avalanche while they're having breakfast one morning, and the father basically runs away and abandons the rest of the family, and then the rest of the movie is kind of the fallout from that instinctual decision. In this movie, he very specifically also grabs his phone before he runs away.
It's a great premise.
Yeah. But I would recommend seeing Force Majeure over Downhill, even though I didn't dislike Downhill. I thought it was okay. And then lastly, we took advantage of Disney Plus doing something nice for their customers, and we watched Onward.
I am so impressed by Disney saying, let's turn this into a positive.
Yeah.
Because I haven't watched it yet, but as someone who's getting a free ride on Disney Plus for a year, that alone makes me want to sign up for it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're in this impossible situation. Why not?
Right. No, I thought it was cool.
You will have the love of America's parents. Now, I remember when the trailers were in theaters, Charlie said he wanted to see it a lot.
Rosie was even more excited to see it than Charlie. They both watched it. I mean, they both, like, specifically paid attention to it, which they don't always with movies. And they liked it a lot. Rosie possibly more than Charlie. I thought it was okay. Like, I thought it was mid-level Pixar, which they've been doing a lot more lately, I feel like. Their last really great one was Inside Out. Before that, I don't know. You know, I didn't love The Incredibles 2. I didn't love Toy Story 4.
No, neither did I.
I still haven't seen Coco, so I'm an asshole because that one could very well be great. I just haven't seen it.
Coco's incredible.
Okay.
Obviously, I have time on my hands in Disney Plus, so I will watch Onward. I remember seeing the trailer and thinking it kind of looks batshit crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird premise, and I applaud them for trying to make something commercial out of such a bizarre premise. I thought it was about as good as, like, How to Train Your Dragon 2.
It's my movie shame. I have seen none of those.
I really liked the first one, never saw the third one. The second one's okay, which is about what I thought of Onward.
I've heard a lot of people sing the praises of the first one, and I kind of wish I had seen the first one before I saw This Is the End.
Okay.
Because that would have made me appreciate the skinny little nerd.
Oh, Jay Baruchel. And supposedly when How to Train Your Dragon came out, it was like 2010, 2011, and it was right at the height of the 3D IMAX trend. And supposedly it was incredible if you saw it that way. I didn't see it in theaters. I didn't see it till it came out on Blu-ray. But supposedly if you saw it in 3D IMAX, it was really something.
Yeah, because there's all that flight stuff.
Right. Let us move on to talk about 1998's The Mask of Zorro, a movie I'm not sure I had seen in 22 years until it came time to do this podcast. I remember going to see it in theaters in 1998 and once more for this show.
And I was about to say the exact same thing. I went to see it in theaters. I loved it. And then, I don't know, time gets away from you. Because I remember loving it, and then I honestly think that a couple days ago when I discovered it was on Netflix, for any of you listening to this who suddenly want to watch it, it is available on Netflix.
And here's what a monster I am. I watched it on Netflix despite owning it on Blu-ray, because I was like, well, I could go down to the basement and get my Blu-ray, or I could just turn it on right here.
Patrick, you have to get used to that, because as a much older, much lazier man than you, you've just described my life. Although, another one of these movies that are played on a seemingly 24-hour continuous loop on one cable channel or another, the Oceans movies?
Yeah.
And usually it's 11 or 13, but lately they've been showing 12 a lot more.
Okay.
And if you get a cable channel with commercials, without exaggerating, they're adding an hour of commercials.
Yeah, that's no good.
So I turn it on, I get hooked, we're watching it, and it's pretty early on, and I say, forget this, I have legs and they work. And so I go in the basement and I grab the disc and I put the disc in and I spin it and I watch it and it's delightful. And then it's over. And then, of course, it goes back to the cable channel and the movie's not even half over.
Oh, my gosh.
And this is supposed to be a personal triumph story of how I got my ass off the couch, but I'm going to tell on myself. Halfway through the story, I realized I did not go in the basement. I did not grab the disc. I went on the cable menu, and it was available VOD. So I said, an hour of my time is worth $5.
Oh, my gosh.
And I rented it.
I was going to jokingly ask, when you said, like, you've just described my life, I was going to jokingly ask if you've ever, like, bought something on VOD that you already own just to save yourself a trip. And you have.
About 2 weeks ago. You know what? I need to install an escalator on those basement steps. That's what I need. Or, you know, some of those Chi-Chi houses have the elevator.
Oh, yeah.
Imagine that. But then you know what that would become. It's 15 steps to the elevator. I have $5. I will seemingly always have $5.
So what did you think of Mask of Zorro upon revisiting it?
I thought it was magnificent. It was everything I remembered. I've got a few very tiny quibbles that I'll bring up, but it has a sweep. It's sort of epic. The cinematography is great. The people behind the movie know how to tell a story.
I was, as I watched it, I was like, oh, this has to be Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio. Sure enough, I was right.
And that's the next thing I was going to bring up, because the only other time I can remember that I had that reaction to a modern film was the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie, that I thought, this is really a throwback to a 50s adventure film.
Yeah.
And I looked it up on the IMDb machine, and wouldn't you know it, and once you know that, their fingerprints are all over it.
Yeah, for sure. What
they know how to tell a story. They know when characters shouldn't talk. The dialogue in the film, I think, is really good, especially in the scenes between, Anthony Hopkins and Antonio Banderas.
Yeah.
There isn't a lot of unnecessary chit-chat, but what both men say is very, very important. But here's the point. And this really impressed itself upon me when I watched it this last time. Spoiler alert. After something bad happens to Antonio Banderas' brother, we see him in a bar, and he's getting drunk, trying to forget. And the filmmakers, the scriptwriter and the director, show him looking up, and in the street, there's two boys playing.
Yeah.
And then we cut back to Banderas, and he looks really, really sad. Now, that's good filmmaking. That should be in a textbook about show, don't tell. And I brought this up to my lovely wife, and she said, the great thing about that is when you do it that way instead of some ham-fisted way through dialogue or something, it's the audience making that connection, and so it's more meaningful.
Right.
Because it's you creating the meaning.
Right.
Oh, he's really sad because he's remembering back when he had this relationship with his brother. And the film does that again and again and again.
Well, and it connects, not only does it allow us to make the connection, but it connects us more deeply to the relationship between him and his brother. We care more about their dynamic and their relationship because we are the ones making that connection and potentially drawing on our own experiences in that moment, as opposed to just him monologuing about, I had this brother and now I'm sad.
Which a lesser film would do. Are we comfortably in spoilers now?
Yeah, I think so.
Because the other thing I wanted to bring up is the further you get into this film, the weirder it gets.
Okay.
But it so much resembles a sort of middle of the road American adventure film from the 50s that you kind of have to pinch yourself and remind yourself. The scene I'm talking about is clearly we don't think we're ever going to see Banderas's brother again.
Right.
And then, courtesy of the Captain Love character, we do.
Yes.
And that is legitimately shocking.
Yeah.
It's a great special effect. I believe most of the effects in this movie are physical effects.
They appear to be.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of CGI. And the weirdest thing is, A, that the Captain Love character would have this talisman of his past. But even weirder is when Banderas drinks water from the jar.
Yes.
That really bothered me. Could it be because of the sort of quarantine we're under now? It's like, dude, don't drink that. You don't know where it's been.
I got upset when I saw them dancing.
The dance scene is delightful. And I love when movies pause to have things like that. But even better than the dance scene, I think, is the scene where Banderas and Zeta-Jones duel.
Well, I love all that stuff in this movie, including the dance scene, because you can see so much of the actors really doing it. They don't cut away to dance doubles. And then, you know, I'm watching it and I'm remembering, oh, right, Catherine Zeta-Jones was in Chicago. She won an Oscar for that. She can dance. But even a lot of the sword fighting, I think the stunt doubling is done very well. I don't think it's super obvious.
With one exception.
Oh, what's the exception?
I was just going to say they could not afford dance or fight doubles for Banderas and Zeta-Jones because they had spent that entire part of the budget on Hopkins' double.
I think it's done pretty well with him, though.
Oh, I agree, but...
We know that it's not him just because of his age and his whatever, but I think it's done pretty well.
Yes, and he acquits himself wonderfully, but for the first hour, I keep wondering why that part is played by Anthony Hopkins.
Well, let's talk about the casting because, you know...
It seems an odd choice, although I think you could guess at some reasons.
The movie came out in 1998.
Yes.
And could never be made today because of the casting. In many ways, it is a relic. It is sort of this last gasp of a certain kind of movie, both good and bad. And we could never cast Latinx actors now,
yes,
in roles that are meant to be that. And so we wouldn't have Catherine Zeta-Jones and we wouldn't have Anthony Hopkins and we wouldn't have Stuart Wilson. The only actor who we would retain is Antonio Banderas. So we are, I feel like, aware of the fact that the casting is hashtag problematic and we can just move on from there.
Yes. And again, I think Hopkins is wonderful. If we were to make the movie today, Tony Amendola, who plays Don Luis, might have a chance at his role. He actually shows up in the sequel as a different character.
I haven't seen the sequel.
I don't think I have either, but he appears very early in the film. And for the rest of the film, I kept referring to him as the poor man's F. Murray Abraham.
Yeah, totally.
Because he looks so much like F. Murray Abraham.
He sure does.
Jose Perez would get to keep his role, and does it not warm your heart when LQ Jones shows up?
Oh, sure.
And it's as if they're making the film for movie lovers.
Right.
Good Lord, that guy had a career. That we think he's gone, and then later on he shows up again, and it's just, yeah, more LQ Jones.
There's all this stuff I want to say, because I want to talk about this being sort of the last movie or part of a dying breed, even when it came out in 1998. There's a great book. I can't remember if it's by Peter Bart or Peter Goober. I think it's Peter Goober, called The Big Picture. And it's entirely about the summer of 1998.
Yes, I've read it.
And it just talks about it. It follows the movies in pre-production, talks about their production, and then talks about the aftermath. And what did we learn from this summer of 1998? Because it's sort of this notoriously bloated summer with a very specific kind of new blockbuster. We have the Roland Emmerich Godzilla, and we have Armageddon, and we have Deep Impact, and we have Small Soldiers, which we just watched under quarantine, and you knew that movie was going to get swallowed up in the summer of 1998.
It's almost like the 90s version of the pictures at an exhibition.
Right.
Very similar tactic.
And The Mask of Zorro did very well. You know,
yeah.
It was a movie that found its place in the summer of 1998. But the writing is kind of on the wall in terms of the kinds of movies that are now starting to be made, especially at this level. This is almost a $100 million movie. And $100 million movies would no longer really look like The Mask of Zorro. They would look more like Godzilla and Armageddon, and they would become $200 million movies and then $250 million movies.
To the detriment of all movies.
I would agree with that. Let me ask you this. What is the difference between an adventure movie and an action movie? Why do we call this an adventure movie and something else an action movie? I don't know this answer.
Just off the top of my head, I would think that an adventure movie is more plot-based and has action sequences, but more like a Raiders of the Lost Ark. An action movie is less concerned with plot and more concerned with violence and destruction.
Okay.
Although, to be fair, The Mask of Zorro has a lot of violence and destruction in it.
Yeah, but it's...
In fact...
It's relegated, I guess, more to, like, set pieces?
Yes, and that's actually one quibble you might have, that when you think about Mask of Zorro, you can sort of see it plotted out on a bulletin board and the action beats being sort of applied. Although there's only one that sort of screams, someone thought there was 20 minutes here without anything. And it's a difficult question. I think we're taken in. I think we really are expected to buy into and enjoy the story of Mask of Zorro.
Yeah. And I think they're very clever about the way that they structure that story, with the whole idea of it's sort of an origin story, but also a story about the passing of a torch. The idea of including sort of the original Zorro, passing it down to a new Zorro, I thought was a really smart way to structure this story.
And that's one of the things I really like about it, because at that point, I compare it to Iron Man. And I had said this before, that when Iron Man came out, I was convinced there were studio executives who thought it was so popular because robots fight at the end.
Right.
But Iron Man spends its first hour in a cave, and we're worried that this guy that we've come to like is going to survive this.
Right, right.
And so we're invested in him coming up with a way to get out of the cave. And that's why I think Iron Man is so great. And I love the origin story here. I think if you could look at Mask of Zorro and say, this is the way to do an origin story.
Well, and it's very smart too, in that by the time we get to the end, we've set up multiple different plot lines and multiple different characters trying to get something or find revenge. It was reminding me sort of the Princess Bride, and the way that we're following different threads, and there's, you know, justice for each of the different characters. And so go ahead.
And that you can have more than one bad guy, because
right.
I'm watching Mask of Zorro, and Stuart Wilson is really, really good. Did you know that he's in the don't segment in
Grindhouse?
Yeah.
I don't think I did.
Did you know that?
I don't think so.
He's the grandpa.
Okay.
I looked him up on the IMDb machine. So Stuart Wilson represents, I think, sort of the banality of evil. That he's not quite bad enough or evil enough to be the only bad guy in the movie. And so that's why we bring in right. Matt Letcher as Captain Love.
Right.
And Captain Love is so awful that I'm watching the movie and I had the same reaction as at your birthday marathon, where I am finally watching Avatar for the first time.
Yeah.
And Stephen Lang is so unrepentantly batshit evil and crazy. All I could think about for the last hour was, what the fuck are they going to do to this guy to satisfy the audience's bloodlust at the end of the movie? That's all I could think of, because Avatar's even later. But even with Mask of Zorro, I'm like, something heinous is going to happen to Captain Love.
Yeah.
It's not going to be pretty. Although, again, this is Elliot and Rossio. When you consider the whole machination of the plot, getting stoned to death by really, really heavy gold bars?
Yeah.
That's pretty awful. That's not good.
It wouldn't be on my list of ways to go.
To paraphrase my 7-year-old self, that wouldn't tickle. I think when I was 7, I used to say that a lot because I was experimenting with irony.
The movie started out, it was going to be first a project for Mikhail Solomon, and then Robert Rodriguez was attached to direct, and he's actually the one who brought Antonio Banderas on.
I would love to see the Robert Rodriguez version of
part of me reads that and is like, well, that's them having sort of a small imagination where it's like, well, we know one Mexican director, so let's have it be Robert Rodriguez. And obviously it ends up not being him, but bringing in Antonio Banderas is pivotal to the movie's success. And, yes. And I hear that and I think, well, he could have never done it. And it wouldn't be anything like the Martin Campbell Mask of Zorro, but having just seen Alita Battle Angel, like when he has the proper resources and the proper support, like Steven Spielberg as a producer, he is capable of doing good work. It's just sometimes when he's left to his own devices to make movies in his garage, they don't come out great.
I think it made me think about James Bond because of the Martin Campbell connection. But my favorite James Bond is Sean Connery because he was
also originally cast in the Anthony Hopkins part.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Because I think of all the actors who have played James Bond, Connery had the right ratio of toughness and sexiness and tongue-in-cheek. And it's a really hard recipe to get right. It's a real hard thing to get the ratios right. And if you look at Banderas in Mask of Zorro, it's perfect. He's capable of being very serious and yet very goofy, too.
Mm-hmm.
And go ahead.
It's something that he's done in a lot of movies. And I've seen a bunch of stuff, especially lately, as he's entered kind of a new phase of his career. Not just the Almodovar movie that he made where he was nominated for Oscars and stuff, but I'm thinking back to even like Expendables 3, which is not a very good movie. And then every time Antonio Banderas comes on the screen, it lights up and you're like, this is a movie I want to watch. And I
haven't seen Expendables, but I would say the exact same thing about him in, believe it or not, Doolittle.
Okay. Yeah. I missed Doolittle.
He is the best thing in Doolittle. And even given the plot, we sit there and wonder why he's not in it more.
He is always a bright spot in almost anything he's in. And I was watching Mask of Zorro feeling like somehow we did Antonio Banderas dirty as a movie star. Because he is technically a movie star. But how many movies has he really been given the opportunity to headline outside of like Desperado? By himself, where he's given full movie star treatment, you know, and Desperado, he's amazing. And Mask of Zorro, he's amazing. And I wish we had gotten more of these kinds of roles for him.
Well, I was just going to say, if you need a little hand chart to how amazing Antonio Banderas is and what his range is, Che in Evita, Zorro in The Mask of Zorro, Puss in Boots, and the Nasonex B.
And even Puss in Boots is the best thing in whatever Shrek movie that is.
I mean, part of it is the animation conceit, but his voice is at least half of it, and it's really funny.
He gets the joke, and he does it. You know, I don't think Mike Myers, for being as legendarily hilarious as he is, ever elevated the Shrek movies with his vocal performance. It's him doing a Scottish accent. It's him doing the grandpa from So I Married an Axe Murderer. It's him doing Fat Bastard.
He had done in other things.
Right. Whereas the vocal performance of Antonio Banderas makes that part much, much better and much, much funnier.
And that's why at the beginning of the podcast when you introduced me, I said, did you miss me? Because I can't do an Antonio Banderas accent at all. But halfway through his climactic fight with Captain Love, they're both waylaid by other things. And then when they go back to fighting, he says that. And it's delightful.
Yeah, he's delightful in this movie. And speaking of delightful in this movie, let's also talk about Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Yes.
Because she had done some movies, and you and I knew her already from The Phantom, where she is great, you know. But it's in a small movie that nobody went to see, and definitely a movie that's trying to do something very similar to The Mask of Zorro with a smaller budget and fewer resources and no audience because nobody went to see The Phantom. But I feel like The Mask of Zorro is the movie that really put her on everybody's radar, where it's one of those holy shit, who is that performances.
And again, like Marilyn Monroe, she's funny and tough and sexy, and that's really hard territory to chart. I'm thinking of the scene where she goes into the marketplace and the woman who used to be her nanny tells her the truth, and she doesn't believe it. And later, there's a scene between her supposed father and Catherine Zeta-Jones and Anthony Hopkins, and some pieces of information are repeated, and we see the expression on Catherine Zeta-Jones's face, and then we cut to Hopkins, and he says, I'm paraphrasing, I'm done. She knows the truth now.
Yeah.
And the only reason why that scene works is because we can see in saying nothing,
right,
that Zeta-Jones has put it together.
Yeah. How come blockbusters aren't made with as much care as this one?
Well, could it be that the gentlemen at the 13th floor are getting too much of the budget for pre-visualization?
Yeah.
And we're not spending that money or time on things like a script or a dialogue polish, or check this out, rehearsal.
Oh, for sure. Rehearsal has been cut down from a lot of movies. I know that to be true.
How many actors have you heard say, no, there's no rehearsal.
Right.
We shoot the rehearsal. And I go back to the original Criterion Collection laser disc of The Graduate, which, as one of the special features, I think it was Time Magazine or Life Magazine or something, took a boatload of pictures in this warehouse because Mike Nichols essentially got 4 or 5 weeks to rehearse.
Okay.
So they rehearsed it like a play, and it's pictures. It's just a warehouse, and there's a bed, and it's Anne Bancroft and Dustin Hoffman doing the famous hotel room scene.
Okay.
Gee, you think that helped?
Right.
You think that helped rehearsing it like a play?
And I don't mean to just sound like an old man grouch, because there are still blockbusters that are being made that are good and that have decent dialogue and that care about story. They're just much fewer and farther between, I think. And seeing something like The Mask of Zorro, which to me still feels like a modern movie because it's
yes.
you know, within the last 20 years, although I guess it is 22 years old at this point. I was sort of lamenting the disappearance of a certain kind of movie, because I don't know that there's anything really, except for maybe that first Pirates movie, that I can compare to this movie in the last 20 years.
And it's a shame, but I actually think there was another one at this point. I'm showing my age. In the last 10 years, there was a movie. No, it's not Mamma Mia. There was a movie that seemed to care about its characters and really take advantage of its location. Because that's another thing that Mask of Zorro and Pirates, the first Pirates movie, does. Really gives you a feel for where we are.
Yeah.
And in both cases, sort of the beauty of it. And my cliche is that when I go to these movies, it's like taking a vacation. But how many movies have we seen where the movie obviously doesn't give a shit about where it's taking place?
I just rewatched for an upcoming podcast. Erica and I just rewatched James L. Brooks's Spanglish. We're not doing a podcast on Spanglish. It's for our 2004 episode. And they green screened the driving shots.
Oh my God.
Like, we can't even just shoot in the suburbs of Los Angeles. We have to green screen the driving shots. You and I think it's fair to say, to speak for you in this regard, are fans of analog over digital when it comes to movie making. And I think that's part of what I'm talking about too, is it's nice to watch something like The Mask of Zorro and see so many analog special effects, so many practical stunts, so many real extras, real locations. I mean, when they get to the mines at the end, you're talking about hundreds of extras and an actual location that they shot in. It's not all because, you know, there are movies that try to do this. I was thinking about like John Carter tries to be an old fashioned adventure movie. Even the aforementioned Avatar, but both of those films get very swallowed up in their special effects.
Very much. Think about LQ Jones at the end, roller coastering the mine car.
Right.
Even that, even if it's a stuntman and when he's flying through the air, I'm guessing it is, that's a real mine car on real tracks.
Right.
Someone had to build that and some guy had to figure out the physics of it.
Somebody really jumped the tree and landed back on the horse. A real person did that. And it's amazing. And
earlier someone did the same thing and missed the horse.
Right.
Which hurts when you're watching the film.
And so it just adds so much enjoyment to be able to appreciate, because I rarely can sit and appreciate the craft of digital effects artists. And that's on me. I know, because it's hard work. And they're doing amazing things, but I rarely sit there and think, boy, they did such a good job with these digital mats and green screens. Whereas where I'm watching something like The Mask of Zorro, I'm thinking about all the work and all the people who, you know, were sewing costumes and finding locations and building sets and rehearsing sword fights. You know, when I can tell that it's Antonio Banderas and Catherine Zeta-Jones really doing this sword fight, I'm thinking about them rehearsing that. And I'm appreciating all the work that went into filming just this one scene, just so they could get it right. And I find myself doing that less and less as I go to movies now, because it's like, well, we'll do it in post.
Maybe part of it is, and at this point, I'm definitely showing my age. The minute you start using CGI, that gives you the ability to expand not just the palette, but expand the size of what you're doing.
Right.
And it sort of becomes overwhelming and an end in itself. Whereas if we're actually going to build the mine and all the scaffolding outside the mine, mm-hmm. it can't be an infinite mine, which we've seen in CGI movies.
Right.
It's like, who built this? Thousands of civilizations?
Right.
There's no reason for it to be that big other than we can. A perfect example of this is in the Leonardo DiCaprio Great Gatsby.
Okay.
When they show his first party, I understand that the filmmakers are engaging in hyperbole, but it's on a scale that's literally impossible. Where do these people go to the bathroom? Do they go out where the ocean is and pee into the lake, into the harbor? It's football fields full of nonsense.
Yeah.
It's literally impossible. And again, I've said all I'm going to say about Great Gatsby, but, and maybe that's the point to make it larger than life and cartoonish, but it gets so big that it's almost hard to appreciate it because you don't know where to look.
So we're appreciating physical limits is what you're saying.
Well, physical limits, again, I think I've talked about this before. The two scenes that I use is there's a fight in Batman Begins and the Quidditch game in the first Harry Potter movie. When I first saw both of those films, it was the first time I had seen an action sequence that was beyond my visual acuity. Both of those scenes reached a point where I could not comprehend what was going on.
Right.
It was too fast.
Yeah.
And in some cases, with movies that rely on CGI, it's too much.
Yeah.
It's too much for me to take in. That being said, as you mentioned, all the physical effects in Mask of Zorro are very well done, and they're on a human scale. And it's not meager. When they lock those people up at the mine, there's quite a few people.
Absolutely.
It's not like they spared expense.
And Martin Campbell is kind of an analog guy, because when you think about what he does with Casino Royale when he comes back to the James Bond movie. That's the whole appeal of that movie, not just that they were, you know, they had a new Bond and he's good and they're telling kind of a back to basic story, but that he brought it back to being more of an analog thing after the digital bloat of something like Die Another Day.
Yeah, and proof of this is, and I'm praying that I'm getting the movie right because they all become one in my brain. Casino Royale is the one where Bond defibrillates himself, right?
Correct.
Oh, yeah. When that happened, it was like, oh, I'm on board for this. This is going to be right up my alley. That's terrific. And analog.
And it was the first movie that really introduced me to parkour, because you have that whole chase scene at the opening. And I'm like, oh, my God, what is that guy doing? Yeah. It was amazing.
That was great. I looked at his filmography, though, and I can't.
He's hit or miss.
Right. He directed one really bad one.
He did a movie called Beyond Borders with Angelina Jolie and Clive Owen. That's truly awful.
Hold on. Let me find it, because okay. I'm looking at his filmography and I got to this one and I was like, I cannot believe that, that the same guy, imagine the forces that were at work here. Hold on, let me find it. It won't take me long.
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, Green Lantern. He did Green Lantern.
That's it. Yeah. Thank you very much. No reason to look anything up when Patrick's around. That threw me for a loop.
Yeah.
Good. Oh, my God. Really, Martin? Science building. Really, Martin?
Well,
science building.
But there's an example of a guy who's maybe ill-suited for this new kind of movie making, because you know that that's a movie made by producers and DC brand managers.
And we were just talking about CGI, and the CGI in Green Lantern, especially when they're flying around in space, is just awful.
Yeah.
It's like a Saturday morning cartoon.
You get why they went to him, but he's not the guy you go to make Green Lantern, you know?
He's the guy you go to make Brown Lantern, which sure. takes place on the mud flats of Arizona.
I will say that I appreciated the fact that Anthony Hopkins just said, fuck it, and talked in his own accent and didn't attempt to do a different accent, because I feel like that would have made the movie even more awkward and weirdly racist.
Or could that be an attempt at internal logic? Because that was before he knew Catherine Zeta-Jones was going to attempt a Mexican accent.
Perhaps.
This was to explain just what an effect Papa had between hanging those flowers on the cradle and talking to her because she likes his voice.
Right.
That's actually something that I found very heartwarming, and that the film doesn't take out the enormous brown shithammer of obviousness that Hopkins says she likes my stories and the wife says she likes your voice. And then later on that becomes the gun in the drawer. I thought that was delightful.
Yeah. No, it's a really, again, it's very sort of classically done. Swashbuckling movies aren't something that I ever think that I like. When people are like, what kinds of movies do you like? I'm never like, I like movies where people do fencing and sword fighting. But every time I see it in movies, I'm like, this is delightful. This is so much fun.
And that's really the final thing that I want to say about The Mask of Zorro. All of the sword fighting is just really, really good.
Yeah.
Really well worked out. And not – there's a certain school of movie sword fighting that's smart-assy. This never becomes smart-assy. Even the scene where Zorro is – sword fighting with two different people at once with a sword in each hand.
Yeah.
It doesn't become a parody. Everyone who sword fights in this movie is really doing a good job, however they achieve the effect.
Right. Can you think of an example of smart-assy sword fighting?
I think Princess Bride comes close, although that's part and parcel of the stylization of the piece.
Right.
There's a terrific sword fight in a movie called The Great Race between Tony Curtis and Ross Martin.
Okay.
And that gets a little self-referential, but because I'm old and I watch old game shows on Buzzer, Ross Martin was on Password a lot. He was considered one of the three celebrities who were like best at it. So he's on Password a lot back when he was doing Wild Wild West. Fencing was his hobby in real life.
All right.
And I used to like stay up until 2 o'clock in the morning when I was in high school, because that's the only time they showed The Great Race. The Great Race is a guilty pleasure. It's big and bloated, but there are pleasures to be found in it. And Ross Martin's bad guy is one of them. He's so good.
I've never seen it.
And both Curtis and Martin did their own fencing.
I like that. Again, it makes such a difference for me when I can actually see the actor doing the thing. You know, think about how much of that has become the entire draw of the Mission Impossible franchise, that like we're going to actually see Tom Cruise doing the thing.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that in this movie. Anthony Hopkins stunt double aside, there's a lot of, hey, we get to see the actor doing the thing.
No, I agree. And finally, if you're listening to this and you're stuck at home and you're looking around for ways to entertain yourself, the original Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn.
Yes.
Errol Flynn and Basil Rathbone are clearly doing their own fencing, and that scene is one for the ages. That sort of becomes the scene that every movie copies right. for the next 10 years.
Yeah, for sure. And I would argue The Princess Bride is also copying.
Yes. The minute both fighters get on a sort of staircase
right
that goes along a column
right,
or maybe we see them in shadow, those two are, yeah, you're in Robin Hood territory there.
Anything else about The Mask of Zorro you want to say?
It's terrific, and it made me sad that I had not revisited it in 2 decades.
Did you like grow up with Zorro at all?
Not really, although the Disney version was shown a lot.
Okay.
And that was fun. That's fun for kids. I must have watched it because the original TV show theme is stuck in my head. And I think when Disney was putting out that vault stuff in those metal cans, I think all of their Zorro episodes was one of the releases in that series.
It's interesting that the movie was such a hit, because it is such an old-fashioned character that even in 1998, I feel like, was kind of out of the public consciousness.
Right. But this is proof that people don't know what they want until stuff is put in front of them, because the success of Mask of Zorro is the same as the success of Pirates of the Caribbean.
But the same can't be said for the success of The Lone Ranger, right? Which was not a hit.
No, it was not. And that is a deeply flawed film.
Yes.
Deeply flawed. But I remember going to see it the weekend it opened and really having high hopes, because in different hands, you could have masked of Zorro. I'm turning it into a verb.
Right.
You could have masked of Zorro'd The Lone Ranger.
And it's by the same filmmaker as Pirates of the Caribbean, so it seems like he's the guy to do it.
Yeah, there's they should have titled it The Lone Ranger in Missed Opportunity.
Yeah, that movie reminded me more of like Wild Wild West than it did The Mask of Zorro.
Oh, and speaking of Wild Wild West, we have Kenneth Branagh. Kenneth, I need it a little bit bigger, playing Professor Loveless. And in Mask of Zorro, we have Matt Letcher playing Captain Love.
Yes.
And I looked him up on IMDb, and boy, he is the definition of a working actor. He has been in everything, including thousands of hours of television. But I noticed, this struck my curiosity, he played Captain Love in Mask of Zorro. He once played Mike Love of the Beach Boys in a made-for-TV movie called The Beach Boys, An American Family.
I remember that TV movie, but I've never seen it.
So he is typecast as Love.
Am I misremembering? In the early 80s, I know we had Zorro the Gate Blade, because that famously is the movie that Thomas and Martha Wayne went to go see the night they were killed. That's the movie that they're going to see in Todd Phillips, The Joker, or just Joker. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And I know we had like a straight adaptation of The Lone Ranger in the early 80s, but there was no straight adaptation of Zorro in the early 80s, correct?
I do not think so. I haven't looked it up, but my guess is that there was a fairly lengthy period where Disney still had the rights.
Okay.
Back from the TV show.
Well, thank you for talking about this movie with me. Thank you for podcasting with me under quarantine. We've only Skyped two shows ever before. One was our live breast cancer podcast-a-thon when you were at Monster Bash.
Yeah.
And do you remember the other one?
I once did Skype with you and Doug for the best of the year.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we've only Skyped twice before, but this was a success, so I thank you for getting this all set up.
I'm not the biggest fan of Skype because I miss the human connection, and although you refused to put your camera up on my screen, I actually found great solace in the fact that for the last hour and something, I've been looking at myself.
Oh, well, good.
My screen is full of my bloated kisser. And I've been keeping myself company
good
for an amount of time. And isn't there a lesson there to be learned for all of us?
Thank you guys very much for listening. Please stay safe. Please stay indoors. And we will be back next week to talk about something else. I don't know what. But thanks again, JB.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.